And we'll move to our third case this morning, the United States against Bogoretti. Herman, whenever you're ready.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Josh Herman, and I am here presenting argument on behalf of Appellant Venkatesh Bogoretti. We raised three issues in our appellate brief, and I'd like to focus on two, sufficiency and the 404B issue. There's some interlocking, but I'm going to try to keep the arguments a bit separate, starting with the sufficiency argument. This case we submit is one of the rare cases that tests what this court announced in Garcia, which is what are the outer limits of the reasonable inferences that can be drawn given the relevant standard of proof. When even giving all reasonable inferences to the government here, the evidence was insufficient as to every count of the murder for hire convictions. Each of those convictions required Bogoretti to use a facility of interstate commerce or to cause another to travel with respect to count four in an interstate manner with the intent that a murder be committed. And when you look at all of the evidence, and especially we submit when you listen to the recordings, there is such a degree of inherent contradictions and uncertainty at every stage. So for instance, when the agent, the undercover agent—
Can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Isn't that uniquely the jury's responsibility to determine those conflicts? Because intent, right, is sort of the fundamental jury issue in a case like this. And why is it not up to the jury to determine whether or not your client had the requisite intent to commit the crimes?
Sure. So let me give you some examples on that, because we first of all, as a framing issue, the intent the credibility arguments and the weighing of the credibility arguments being the province of the jury is not the type of argument that we're making here. It's when you look at the evidence, even on its face, when you look at Bogoretti's statements on their face, they create a contradiction, an inherent contradiction
That's the problem I've got.
So let me give you an example.
Because if there was no contradiction, the argument would be there's no evidence that he acted with criminal intent. And then you'd have a sufficiency of the evidence problem. But when there's a conflict, why is that not an issue for the jury?
It's a conflict between what Bogoretti said and what the agent interpreted him to say. That's what the conflict is. So, for instance, when the agent at the June 6, 2019 meeting asked Bogoretti, and this is after the word gone is used, which the government and in the district court's Rule 29 order places an unbelievable amount of weight on the word gone. After the agent says, do you want him gone? And then there's some garbled communication that the agent then says, do you want him hurt or killed? And Bogoretti's answer is, I don't know.
Well, but wait a minute. Bogoretti says, here, let me just read it. Bogoretti says, he can't. I'm talking like a coma, like that. The agent says, yeah, I mean, the only problem with that is that's hard to do, right? And Bogoretti says, yeah, so the other way.
So Judge, but back before he even says that exchange happens, first of all, the word coma means that Bogoretti is coming into the situation not with an intent to kill, but with an intent to do something short of killing. But even before that, the agent asked him, do you want him hurt or killed? And Bogoretti says, I don't know. And even until the very end, the last meeting, Your Honor, October 2nd, 2019, Bogoretti is saying, I want to give him some chance. This is wrapped around comments throughout the meetings when the agent is pushing the idea of using a gun. First meeting, you want me to get a gun? Bogoretti, no. Last meeting, the first thing that Bogoretti says when he walks into the meeting, no gun, no shooting, some type of accident. A crash is okay.
Train looks good. Train thing looks.
So on that, Your Honor, that is beyond an impossibility. And when
he says, Bhagiratha, the agent says dead, question mark. Bhagiratha says, yeah, even doesn't dead or in a crash, good enough. And the agent says, well, it's going to be probably dead. And Bhagiratha says, that will be okay.
But then he proposes, he agrees with the agent's idea of pushing this man
in front of a train.
In front of a train in New York when the man works at home from New Jersey. And when in that same conversation, when the agent brings up the train, Bhagiratha's own words were not that he goes there. This is also the same meeting when there is an agreement.
It's just a dispute about the method, not the.
But in
the goal,
but
for lack of a better way to put it,
in the context of everything, when he's supposed to bring also to this meeting half down for it to even proceed, and he comes up short, it is all said and done. One of the factors that moves this type of evidence into what we see in some cases of the equipoise, where there's a balancing of the evidence that does not tip it to beyond a reasonable doubt. So for instance, back to the question about like the, I don't know. If I were to ask my son, do you want to go to Michigan or Illinois? And he says, I don't know. And then I were to tell his mom, exercising all of my biases, saying he wants to go to Michigan, right? And that would be an unfair and unreasonable and in fact, irrational, conclusion from what he said. Even if he said at some time during conversations or looking at schools, I like Michigan, I like Illinois, I like them both. Ultimately, what Bhagiratha says at each and every meeting is, I don't know, you tell me what to do. There is a degree of uncertainty, especially when coupled with the ultimate plan on October 2nd. After 4 months of meeting is this train pushing incident where Bhagiratha says at the same time, not that he goes there, right? And I take Your Honor's point that it's about a method, but contrast it to the methods that he rejected. The methods that he rejected include specifically using a gun. And you look at the other murder for hire cases that this court has considered, Mendel, Caguana, those cases all involve guns, a method of killing that leaves no doubt. And in this particular case, Bhagiratha is all over the place. He's looking for the agent for guidance, which expresses that he does. He's asking the agent, you tell me what to do.
So hold on. So is your argument, Mr. Herman, that the government has proved beyond a reasonable doubt that the defendant intended to badly hurt Mr. Ganassetti, but they did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he wanted to murder Mr. Ganassetti?
That was the defense at trial, Your Honor, that the...
But the point you're making here that these are subject... I think anybody in the room that read these transcripts would say these are two people that are talking either about really, really badly hurting somebody or killing somebody.
And Your Honor, the defense at trial again was that the discussions showed an intent to cause bodily injury to harm, but not to kill, and ultimately to make that gap, that jump.
Right. So we know the jury convicted, right? And the conviction's being challenged on appeal. So the point I'm trying to make to discern from the argument you're advancing in the room here today is, are you saying there's one and only one way to view this evidence? And it is beyond the pale to view the evidence as involving discussion of a murder. But it is absolutely fair to view the evidence as a discussion about one person hiring another to badly hurt a third party.
That would be that latter point. That would be a reasonable inference to draw from the conversations. It would be an unreasonable inference in light of him saying, I don't know, of what he wants to do when it's a decision between hurt or killed. And when he specifically says, when asked what he wants to do, promotes the idea of a coma, mentions beating him up in other situations, that he is expressing something short of murder. And that's where his intent lies. And in light of the inherent contradictions of what he wanted to do with respect to murder, we would submit that that would jump the rail for an unreasonable inference. I'd like to switch to the 404B issue, unless there's points on the sufficiency, because this is where I think that the arguments with 404B interlock with the sufficiency arguments, because you can see from the government's arguments on appeal, Bhagireddy's statements at the first meeting about researching how to use insulin to kill his wife in her sleep played a crucial role in the testimony at trial. And even though the government in its brief says it didn't talk about any kind of plans, in the closing argument, I believe it's at page 1325, the prosecutor specifically said that after talking about how Bhagireddy had thought about and talked about killing his wife, says that he is obviously talking about these plans with his father. So the fact that Bhagireddy is also talking about killing his wife, which is not charged, but it is a wrong. I don't think that there can be any debate about that, that him articulating something that he had quote unquote researched about how to kill his wife would qualify as a 404B wrong. And the government in our post-trial pleadings and in Judge Wood's ruling treats it as a 404B wrong, means that there was a particular type of analysis that had to be done, which completely was not done here. And in 2014, Chief Judge Sykes, you authored Gomez, and it's been since at least 2014 when there was a couple of companion cases where this court has provided district courts with a clear roadmap of how to do 404B arguments. And what the district court did, both pre-trial at app 7, page 7 and 8, and then in its Rule 29 order, I think at pages 21 and 22, is completely ignore that roadmap.
Isn't that harmless error, though?
No, not. It's not harmless error for two reasons. One, we would submit that the harmless error analysis should subtract the evidence of the testimony of the agent talking about Bhagireddy's plans to kill his wife. That's the necessary component of this affecting substantial rights as you look at the evidence without the improperly introduced evidence. Secondly,
I'm not talking about the verdict. I'm talking about, wasn't it harmless error as to the judge applying the pre-Gomez inextricably intertwined standard?
No, it wasn't, because if there's not clarification that you need to consider the non-propensity evidence or non-propensity reason for the 404B evidence, any district courts can simply say it goes to motive and intent without looking about whether or not that particular evidence is still in and of itself propensity. So in the government's brief,
can they be both? A lot of evidence that goes to motive and intent is propensity evidence, I would submit, probably all of it,
right? But for this that's also where 403 needs to serve as a bulwark here. And there's absolutely no analysis of 403 here. So as an example, I think it might have been the Schmidt case from 2014 or another case. When you look at an example of the 404B, it's somebody who is has drugs in a house and a possession of a gun, and then you introduce the drugs in the house to show that he's having the gun in furtherance of protecting the drugs. Or in more recently, there was
Mr. Herman, wouldn't we do the 403 analysis? I mean, couldn't we do the 403 analysis? The alternative is what, to send this back for a new trial?
It is, Judge, because that evidence of the testimony regarding
But I'm trying to figure out the chain of reasoning here.
Yeah.
If we said, all right, under your articulation of the harmless error standard, we subtract the evidence from the calculus, okay, from what the jury considered, then we conduct our own harmless error analysis. Is that what you're suggesting, to determine whether there was enough evidence to convict?
My proposal would be to obviously reverse for a new trial, because the jury needs to hear this case without it being polluted and infected with what was clearly propensity evidence. This was evidence that he intended to kill somebody else, another family member, which is the, and he's charged with a murder for hire of yet another family member. It is just a bullseye example of showing that he has a likelihood to kill other people and family members. In the trial centered around that in many ways, through closing argument, through opening argument, through the agent saying he wanted to kill his wife over and over again, and he had plans. If there's no other questions on that point, I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you. Morgan.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the court. My name is Alex Morgan, and I represent the United States. I'd like to start with the 404B issue. The district court here was well within its discretion in admitting the defendant's statements about wanting to kill his wife. The defendant's statements about wanting to kill his wife were evidence of defendant's intent, his motive.
Ms. Morgan, can I ask you a question? Do you agree that the district judge applied the wrong pre-Gomez standard in determining the admissibility of the evidence?
I don't, Your Honor. I think what, if you read that opinion, I think what the district court is saying, and maybe it's less put a little inartfully, but I think what the district court was saying, what the district court was consistent in throughout it, its dealing with this issue, is that it didn't view this evidence as other acts. It viewed this as direct evidence of the charged crime, as motive and intent that go into the direct evidence of the charged crime. And so even in that ruling where that citation occurs, which I agree is no longer good post-Gomez, the principle from that case that direct evidence falls outside of the 404B analysis, that's still good post-Gomez. And I think that is what the district court was saying.
The reason she gave for that is inextricably intertwined. Gomez.
Understood. And I think that citation and the parenthetical may be erroneous.
Yeah,
but
it doesn't seem to me to be direct evidence either. I mean, I have a hard time of figuring out how it's direct evidence. I think the government's theory is defendant is divorcing his wife. Wife's uncle is paying the legal fees to support the wife's divorce. And if the uncle was vanished or hit by a train, I suppose, then there would be nobody to pay the fees for the wife for the divorce. So that has nothing to do with the death of the wife.
Understood.
I mean, it goes to motive. I mean, I'm with you on the motive and intent stuff.
Right. And I admit that it's a little bit of a close call on whether it's direct evidence or whether it's 404B evidence. And I don't think it ultimately matters because both motive and intent are permissible purposes under 404B. The district court ultimately, though it thought that it was direct evidence, did the 404B analysis as well, discuss the evidence in terms of the motive and intent, did the 403 balancing analysis that is required under Gomez, and then additionally limited the way in which the government could use the evidence at trial. And so the way that the government is arguing this evidence, the way that the jury heard about this evidence, is in terms of his motive and his intent. The defendant's intent was the key disputed issue here at trial. And the statements about his wife demonstrated his genuine intent to kill the uncle. The defendant's statements about killing his wife showed that he was serious about killing the wife's uncle, as opposed to just harming the wife's uncle, which is the theory of the case that defendant presented.
Ms. Morgan, the difficulty that I have with it is I don't understand why the government was so intent on proving that he wanted to kill his wife. The indictment charged him with wanting to kill the uncle. And it seems to me the government would have had plenty to say, why does he want to kill the uncle? Because the uncle is encouraging a divorce. And the divorce is choppy and messy, as they always are, or often are. And that's why he wanted to kill the uncle. Why does the government have to get anywhere near this additional intent to want to kill the wife. That's not what the indictment is about.
I agree that the government didn't need that evidence necessarily, but I think that given that intent was a disputed issue here, the defendant's intent, his desire, not necessarily any plan to kill the wife, but his desire to do so tells us something about the divorce. It tells us something about his state of mind. And it tells us something about what he was willing to do in order to accomplish his ultimate goal. His ultimate goal was to permanently end his wife's ability to litigate the divorce proceedings and to cause him troubles with the custody of his children. So it wasn't that, so that the fact that that was his ultimate goal, I think, is really informed by his desire and what he's saying about killing his wife.
Both sides are sort of ignoring the elephant in the room, which is the entrapment defense and the elements of the entrapment defense. Sorry. Predisposition,
yes,
and lack of government inducement, or government inducement, I should say. So the government has to prove predisposition and a lack of government inducement once entrapment is put into evidence, as it was here. And so the sufficiency argument, the 404B permissible purposes for the other acts evidence here, the desire to kill his wife, etc. That all has to be filtered through the nature of the case, which is it's an entrapment case. And the way this was initiated is that the defendant talked to an acquaintance about killing his wife, potentially the uncle. The acquaintance goes to the ATF. The ATF sets up a operation sting something here and sends an agent out to pose as a hitman, a biker hitman. And so that's the context in which both the 404B evidence and the sufficiency of the evidence argument that are being raised on appeal needs to be evaluated, including any harmless error if the wrong legal standard was used by the district court in admitting the evidence about the wife.
Understood, Your Honor. And I think that a rational jury could easily have found here that there was sufficient evidence to show.
Let's start with the 404B, because then that's
understood.
The evidence, so, argument that's being made.
Yes.
And there was no, there was no limiting instruction on the proper purposes
of course
of the argument of this evidence, which was a pretty glaring omission as well, although there's no instructional error being advanced because apparently there was no request for a limiting instruction.
That's correct. There wasn't a request for limiting instruction. And I will note on the entrapment part, this wasn't an argument that the government made below, but in terms of how the government argued predisposition at closing, the government pointed to the statements about the wife and said, look, he's predisposed to do this. If this were to go back, I think that would be an argument that could be advanced as well, is that not only does it those statements come in for motive and intent, they also come in for predisposition. And as the jury was instructed, predisposition looks at a person's character and kind of opens up this whole can of worms in that respect. So this evidence was certainly appropriate evidence of predisposition once the defendant put that entrapment defense at issue. And I think the evidence of predisposition goes beyond just the statements about the wife. The defendant came to that very first meeting knowing exactly what he wanted to do. He had this problem of his very bitter divorce, and he had thought about a solution. He wanted to get rid of the uncle. He came to the meeting with, you know, prepared to discuss sort of the best way to get this done. And as defense counsel points out, there was some debate. They're talking about how is the best way to do this. But ultimately, he had his mind made up even at that very first meeting. And I'd like to point to the fact, too, that the defendant had already discussed this with his father, who was a police officer in India, to sort of discuss how to get away with this type of crime. And I think all that just goes to show that the defendant was ready and willing to commit the murder for hire offense. If your honors don't have any other questions on entrapment, I'd like to just briefly touch on the sufficiency as to the intent. I think a lot of these issues are overlapping, and so we've kind of touched on a lot of what goes into the defendant's intent. But I think as to every count, the evidence was more than sufficient to show that defendant had the requisite intent here that a murder for hire be committed. He came to that meeting knowing what he wanted done. He used words like taken care of, but confirmed ultimately through his conversations with the undercover agent what he was looking to get done, including agreeing to a plan to push the victim in front of a train. And the defendant throughout these meetings continued to make that intent clear, including giving the undercover agent thousands of dollars, his wife, uncle's picture and address and information so that he could carry out the crime. If there are no further questions, the government requests that this court affirm the defendant's convictions and sentence.
Thank you. Mr. Herman, I think you had used almost all your time, but you can have an extra couple of minutes to...
Thank you, Judge. So I'd like to address the point about the entrapment defense and predisposition. We acknowledge there's a fine line and sometimes even overlap between predisposition and propensity. How we addressed this in our reply brief was, at least in this circuit, in the McGill case, there's a tightened a comparison between the charged offense and what you are making for an entrapment argument. So your character is just not some free-floating, every bad thing you've ever said could be relevant to whether or not you were predisposed to doing something else that was bad. So we'd rest on the arguments that really focus on McGill, and I think the government cited a case, an older case, looking at, based on Ninth Circuit jury instructions, talking about similar enough offenses. Judge Scudder raised an important point about the that I want to draw a line under regarding the relevancy of the separate and apart from the entrapment issue about these comments at all. The district court's Rule 29 order opens up by talking about how Bhagirathi was indicted by a grand jury in connection with his efforts to hire a hitman to murder his wife's uncle in response to the uncle's support of his wife during the contentious divorce. The relevancy of his intent and motive was the fact of a pending divorce proceeding, not any underlying animus, and certainly not a plan and desire to kill his wife. So we would submit that even out of the gate, the 404B analysis stumbles. Absent any other questions, we appreciate the opportunity to present these arguments and would respectfully request that the convictions be vacated and it be resent to the district court. Thank you.
You very much. Our thanks to all counsel. We'll take the case under advisement. We're going to take another very brief recess to summon the attorneys in the next three cases and allow some additional students to come in.